supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mark Eichmann, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Finding a place to smoke on New Jersey beaches will be a lot tougher starting next year when a new law takes effect. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports Governor Phil Murphy signed it today in Long Branch.
Today, New Jersey is taking action to get the butts off the beach.
That's cigarette butts. And Governor Murphy says too many people use Garden State beaches as one giant ashtray.
Among the litter picked up by volunteers last year, get ready for this is extraordinary, 29,000 cigarette butts, more than 1,150 lighters, and nearly 1,900 empty cigarette packs. And for good measure, 7,172 cigar tips.
State Senate President Steve Sweeney reintroduced the bill in Trenton this year after he couldn't convince former Governor Chris Christie to sign it. He says they needed a statewide policy instead of varying town to town.
I remember when we banned smoking in restaurants and public buildings, people said restaurant business was going to go down 20%. It went up. Our beaches are only going to get better because of what we're doing here.
The law does give towns some say. They can choose to leave up to 15% of the sand as a smoking section. Governor Murphy says the state isn't going to enforce the ban, which has fines up to $1,000 per violation.
I guess it's going to depend on the local jurisdiction. And that's the way it should be.
Assemblywoman Valerie Huddle says the ban also helps send a non-smoking message to children.
To see as a role model, when you see other people smoking on the beaches and the parks, you really don't want your kids to even see that.
19 New Jersey towns already banned lighting up on the sand. If you like to enjoy a smoke while taking in some sun, nothing changes for the rest of the year. The law kicks in January 1st. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
When the U.S. Supreme Court upheld President Trump's travel ban last month, it did so by officially condemning a past court ruling that was used to justify the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Ironically, Japanese American civil rights groups have condemned Trump's travel ban as a thinly veiled attempt to discriminate by religion against a certain group of people in the name of national security. The World War II era case was brought by a Japanese American named Fred Korematsu. But WHYY's Chris Barish reports that you would be wrong if you thought Korematsu would consider the Supreme Court's condemnation of the internment camps a victory. Speaking today in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, Fred Korematsu's daughter, Karen, says this is a terrible way for her father to be exonerated.
He would be very sad and he'd be very disgusted. He would feel that, you know, he fought all these years so something like this wouldn't happen.
Fred Korematsu was a 23-year-old living in the Oakland, California area in 1942 when, unlike his parents, he refused to comply with then-President Franklin Roosevelt's order to report to an internment camp. He was caught and jailed, but challenged his imprisonment on constitutional grounds. The High Court disagreed. By the 1980s, the Korematsu ruling, which still stood, was considered by many to be one of the Supreme Court's worst decisions. But in the travel ban opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that his predecessors were, quote, gravely wrong and had been overruled in the court of history. Korematsu had his conviction overturned in 1983 and later received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He died in 2005, but his daughter Karen has started an education institute in his name. On Friday, she addressed about 75 teachers from across the country at the Nonpartisan Freedoms Foundation at Valley Forge. Karen Korematsu told WHYY that while her father was righteous, he never became bitter and was a leader in his community's Lions Club, Boy Scout Troop, and Presbyterian Church.
History should remember my father as one man who made a difference in the face of adversity and believed that being an American means to support citizens and non-citizens.
Attendee Amy Merkley, who teaches middle school civics and history near Seattle, said more Americans need to know Korematsu's story.
It's important we know our history, the good, bad, and the ugly. There's a lot of focus on Confederate monuments coming down, but there's more to our story than just that struggle.
The Institute has created a curriculum that teachers can use to educate their students. Chris Barish, WHYY News.
Hurricane season is officially underway, but the peak of the anticipated storm season won't arrive until mid to late August. The National Weather Service predicts this year's storms will be about average or maybe above average, with 10 to 16 named storms and 1 to 4 major hurricanes. Those predictions use sophisticated computer modeling, but should the forecasters also look to the trees? One local researcher says yes. That's Delaware State University professor Christopher Heckscher. He's just published a study that says the breeding habits of a migratory bird species that nests in Delaware can predict the severity of the coming hurricane season. Professor Heckscher, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight. Appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
So your study centers around the veery, which is a songbird species I'd never heard of. Tell us a little bit about what kind of bird the veery is, what it looks like, where it lives, what it eats.
Okay, the veery is a thrush, so it's closely related to the robin, which a lot of folks might be familiar with. It's a little bit smaller than a robin that you might see in your yard. It's just basically a brown bird with a white belly that lives in the forest understory. They migrate every fall down to South America and then return back to the Northeast to breed.
And so you've been studying them for some length of time. How did you come to connect the length of their breeding period with tropical storms and how severe those storms are going to be?
Let me start off by saying, if you're a little bird and you have to migrate from, let's say, Delaware down to Brazil, which is where they spend the winter, you want to make sure that you're going to have a safe flight. And if you're out over, say, the Caribbean Sea or the Gulf of Mexico, and you're flying along and there's no place to land and you encounter a hurricane, you can imagine that's going to cause some problems for you. So I noticed that these birds stopped nesting earlier in some years than others on my study site in Delaware. And it's something I'd been aware of for a long time, but I hadn't put much thought to it. But it suddenly occurred to me that there could be something going on during the fall when they're migrating to South America that might cause them to stop nesting early. So if they stop nesting early, they might have more time to migrate during the fall. They might have a longer period of time to get ready to migrate before they leave Delaware. So it just occurred to me to look at maybe tropical storms might be something that they're trying to avoid, or perhaps get to South America a little bit early so they might skip some of the peak of the hurricane season, which is in September and October. And I just looked back through my data going back almost 20 years and found that there was a pretty strong relationship.
It does sound a little bit like something you'd read in the Farmer's Almanac. how consistent have they been in predicting storm severity? Did they get it wrong some year, and do some of these birds get stuck in really bad storms? Or?
Yeah, they do get it wrong. I found that the correlation between the timing of the time when they lay their eggs at White Clay Creek State Park and the number of hurricanes that they might encounter during the following fall is about between 50 and 60%. You know, it's not 100%, so some years they are off, but that correlation is actually quite high compared to other ways that we've tried to predict hurricane seasons. If you look at the correlations that NOAA and some of the other universities have done using meteorological data, their correlations are only between about 40 and 50%. For their predictions at the time that the veeries are nesting. So it's actually turned out that the veeries are better predictors, early season predictors of the following hurricane season than some of the other major meteorological groups that put out these predictions every summer.
What is the meaning for weather forecasters or for others looking at, you know, computer models and very in-depth simulations? Can the veery sort of confirm their expectations? What's the takeaway from this?
Well, there's lots of things that we can learn from this. One of the things that I'm hoping is that the veeries might actually be using something in the atmosphere or the environment that meteorologists may not be aware of yet. And because they're such good predictors, the birds, that is, you know, maybe we should look at the environmental conditions that the veeries might be using to adjust their nesting season. Clearly, they know by, say, mid-May at the latest what the hurricane season is likely to be in September and October. So they're using something out there that so far, at least it appears, is a better predictor than some of the parameters the meteorologists have been using. I mentioned earlier the birds do spend 8 months of their year down in the Amazon basin in Brazil. So I suspect that there's something happening down there that's affecting the bird's physiology that then sets them up to prepare for a strong hurricane season. And then conversely, if they're not likely to encounter many tropical storms or hurricanes in the fall, they can extend their breeding season, which is good if you're a veery.
All right, Delaware State University Professor Christopher Heckscher, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Sure, my pleasure.
Fallout from Monday's private summit and public press conference with President Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin continues to dominate the news. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller decided to get a better understanding of how Americans regard Russia by speaking with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. It may not be surprising, but even before the summit, Americans weren't too keen on the Kremlin.
Frank, we've seen a good deal of bipartisan accord in the wake of President Trump's questioning of the extent of Moscow's interference in U.S. elections. What do Americans make of the relationship with Russia?
Well, we've looked back at our data, all of which were collected, I should say, before the events of the last several days. So these are pre-existing sentiments towards Russia, and they're all negative, even among Republicans. Bipartisan consensus on an unfavorable view of Russia as a country, and bipartisan consensus on not liking Putin. Now, there are some differences. One of the changes we've seen in the data over the last couple of years with Trump in office is Republicans becoming a little more, modestly more positive on all those measures, but they're still well below the majority line. So just to repeat, when we look at the pre-existing context, which was there when Trump went to Helsinki to meet with the Russian leader, we have 72% of Americans who said unfavorable towards Russia. We had 66% who said Russia was an enemy or at least unfriendly, and we had 72% who were negative towards Putin, and that's all Americans put together. There are partisan gaps there, but not nearly as big as we see gaps on partisanship by many, many other measures that we've talked about, Dave.
Frank, this week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that intelligence assessments are clear that Russian leader Putin ordered an influence campaign. Is there any ambiguity in the minds of Americans over this issue?
All the polling that I look at, including a couple of spot polls that have been done since the Helsinki summit with Putin and the fallout that came thereafter, show that Americans clearly, the majority of Americans clearly do think that Russians were involved in meddling, if that's the right word, in U.S. elections.
Frank, in advance of Senate judiciary hearings regarding Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, has the public had time to make an informed opinion of him?
Well, it's always unclear exactly how informed American opinions are about these nominees. But one thing we've done here at Gallup, Dave, going all the way back to Bork. Remember him, Robert Bork, who was nominated by Ronald Reagan back in 87? For most of the nominees, we've gone in pretty soon after they were nominated and asked a very basic question. Would you like to see the Senate vote in favor of the nominee serving on the Supreme Court or not? So we put Brett Kavanaugh in that same context, and what we're finding here is that the support for his nomination is the lowest that we've seen across a wide number of nominees. 41% of Americans say the Senate should vote in favor, 37% not in favor. For Neil Gorsuch, who was the last nominee, of course, it was 45%, 32, a little more positive. And then we can go back in time. Let me just pick out one, John Roberts, who was nominated by George W. Bush to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. 59% of Americans back in 05 said Senate should vote in favor of John Roberts. So I think it's reflecting of polarization out there. Democrats are just much more likely to say no, no, no to anybody that Trump nominates. Republicans more likely to say yes, yes, yes. So Kavanaugh has now found himself caught in this partisan divide that probably mirrors the very close margin of the vote that's going to come in the Senate.
Is another variable potentially that being that it is perceived that the complexion of the court will fundamentally change at this juncture if he is sworn into office?
That's a good point. We don't know that for sure, but it may be that informed voters, when they answer our questions, are aware of the fact that this may be somewhat more of an important nominee in terms of, as you say, changing the complexion of the court than might have been the case for some of the other nominees who are going to replace somebody of a similar ilk and therefore didn't have much impact.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Two artists have collaborated on an immersive art and dance labyrinth in South Philadelphia. A muralist and a choreographer created a series of fantasy rooms, taking audiences inside the mind of an artist at work. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports on Figmago.
Artist Meg Saligman has done some very prominent public work in Philadelphia, including the Common Threads mural at Broad and Spring Garden Streets, which features a teenager pulling on her braids, and the huge American flag near Spring Garden on Delaware Avenue. She wanted to open her studio in South Philly to public tours so people could see her process soup to nuts, from preliminary photography to the technical challenge of assembling a large-scale image.
I would be mortified if you came in my studio and got a normal studio tour, right? God forbid you were bored or it was as expected.
Saligman brought in Brian Sanders, whose dance troupe has been a staple of the annual Fringe Festival for 20 years. Together, they transformed a large studio on Bainbridge Street into a maze of small rooms and hallways. Guests can explore imaginative tableaus populated by dancers. What starts as a studio tour about the technical process of making murals turns into a deep dive into the sometimes messy internal process of imagination. And, like with Willy Wonka, the audience is expected to participate.
You know, the journey through the mind of an artist is a lot of work.
That is Brian Sanders, the choreographer, who came up with the name Figmago by combining figment, as in imagination, with imago, the final developmental stage of a butterfly. Figmago, the dance installation, will be performed every weekend through the end of September. Sanders hopes this format of collaborative, exploratory theater could be a prototype of a more permanent cultural attraction in Philadelphia.
The traditional venue, the traditional lines and rows of chairs in the audience, you know, has been challenged by these new experiences in game rooms and artist installations that, you know, you have to explore and climb on and experience.
Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
No strangers to the underdog status, Philadelphians have long stood under the cultural shadow of New York City. New Yorkers have long touted the superiority of their city's nightlife, architecture, public transit, pizza, bagels, and much more, with chance of only in New York. But an affordability crisis is forcing artists, immigrants, and others who live on the margins to find cheaper living in different cities. WNYC's Matt Katz decided to focus on the New York exodus to Philadelphia, where longtime New Yorkers are not just finding cheaper rent, they're finding out that the Big Apple isn't as unique as they once thought.
When Kim Yoon left China, there was only one place to go.
They say, if you go to New York, you see the yellow one, the taxi? That's the New York.
Jung arrived in 1979 at the age of 17. More than 20 years later, Jung's Buddhist temple in New York moved to Philadelphia, converting two row homes into a calming sanctuary of ringing bells and porcelain Buddhas. As Jung began visiting her temple on the weekends, she noticed something about Philadelphia. It was like an entirely different economy. Bok choy in New York cost as much as 99 cents a batch.
And here I get 39 cents.
So she left her cramped quarters on East Broadway in Chinatown in 2003, and she followed her fellow parishioners to Philly. For less money, Jung could make mortgage payments on a house with a vegetable garden. She quickly saved money to buy another house, and another. She's a landlord now, with five houses in the city.
One only cost me $40,000. New York City right now is expensive. No one can stay there.
New York's affordability crisis is forcing out not just immigrants, but artists and artisans. Down the block from Jung's Buddhist temple, I meet Brian Christopher.
My company's name is Bicyclette. You can put your own spin on it.
Christopher crafts wooden furniture, not bikes. He started his business while living in Chelsea, but Bicyclette didn't take off until he got to Philly, where rent was 50% cheaper. He now works at a place called Bach. It's a former high school converted into a full square block of workspaces with two bars on the roof that have some of the best Philadelphia skyline views around.
There really is like no end. There's a bakery, there's a kitchen, there's photography studios, tattoo parlor, scientists, there's a glass blowers in the basement. I mean, you could like name something and it's probably here.
Bach is headquarters for plenty of other former New Yorkers too. The Italian sportswear company Diadora just moved its North American operation here. New Yorkers have long relocated to Philly, but this most recent migration is fueled by immigrants. The number of Philadelphia residents born abroad increased 69% since 2000. Many stopped for a few months or years in the shadow of Lady Liberty, but they soon found a smaller, more manageable place in Philly.
I grew up in Brooklyn. Now, around Linden Boulevard is what I can barely remember. And it was a fun, happy life.
Silva St. Al was born in Haiti and moved to Brooklyn as a kid. He got into cooking through a culinary class at John Dewey High School, and he enjoyed a thriving career as a chef in Manhattan. Then, while on a job interview at a restaurant in Philadelphia, he stayed for a few days. And he was hooked.
I spent 2 days in Philadelphia, in Old City, and just kind of fell in love with it.
He got the job and later opened his own restaurant, Maison 208. Silva said he and his wife still feel like New Yorkers. They like the bustle, but
once we got to Philadelphia, it was just like, okay, not all big major cities are not as crazy as New York. And they don't have to be in order to be great.
New York expats bemoan the lack of organic wine shops or great late-night jazz. But Philly still has what diverse New Yorkers might want, especially when it comes to food. The Brooklyn supermarket for Russian and Eastern European cuisine, Netcost, now has two outposts in Northeast Philadelphia.
They have this whole section of marinated mushrooms and stuff, like pickled mushrooms, which I eat a lot of.
Lena Parcell was born in Poland and for years worked in fashion in New York, sleeping in the living room of a shared one-bedroom apartment in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. She got laid off. She followed her Philadelphia boyfriend, now husband, Mike. They live in a house that's 2,900 square feet, with a backyard big enough for a playhouse for their daughter.
My yard in Brooklyn was my fire escape.
We can also walk to get the best pizza in America from here.
Wait, what? Okay, true, nearby Pizzeria Badia has gotten national praise, but Lena drops another bomb about another critically acclaimed place in her neighborhood, Philly-style bagels.
I've never had a better bagel in my life.
That hurts, New York, I know. But heed the warning. Bagels, pizza, and immigrants finding the American dream. New York's affordability crisis is becoming Philadelphia's boom. Matt Katz, WNYC News.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. We had help this week from Edward Saakashvili. The news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Colinari. John Massoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Mike Villers, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Mark Eichmann for Newsworks Tonight.